Hey guys, I'm Raph.
And I'm James.
On today's episode,
The Psychiatrist's Guide to
Mental Health Apps. Maybe they're like Russian hackers. They're trying to tap into our mental health. Actually, that's not a bad idea, to be honest with you. I hope so, because we're doing it.
Yeah, it is the future. Exactly. There's no doubt about it.
The future is here.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special guest for you today. A man.
The myth.
The myth. The legend. Senthil, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Senthil Rajaram. I am a graduating PGY4 from Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. And today, it's my honor to be with these two extraordinary gentlemen here, Dr. Scherer and Dr. Koira.
It's my honor. The honor is all mine. And so anyway, he's here. He's a living legend. He's going to UPenn for geriatric psychiatry, one of the select few, one of the elite. And
real quick, actually, what made you choose geriatrics?
So over the years, during my training at Rutgers NJMS, I had several encounters at the Veterans Affairs Hospital where I had to treat elderly veterans, both from Vietnam, from Korean War, and even some of them from World War II. So when I dealt with this special population, there were unique challenges that I had to face, especially when it comes to treatment planning and also when it comes to like helping out in the optimal way. So I developed a special interest in this area, especially in neurocognitive disorders, treating geriatric depression, addressing unique psychosocial needs of this population.
It's not easy, right?
And there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of medications that shouldn't be prescribed that are commonly prescribed to the elderly population.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. That's the real world challenge. Like you see a lot of these veterans being treated on the outside and there are so many different medications and each of them can cause its own side effects. Mm-hmm.
Such as sudden death. In the case of antipsychotics.
Yeah. Right.
So we're here today to talk about mental health apps. Now, Dr. Scherer and I had the privilege to attend grand rounds given by Dr. Rajaram.
I was breathless throughout the grand rounds. And it's the kind of topic where, you know, I didn't even know what was out there in terms of mental health apps. I didn't know that there were so many. I didn't know that they were being used actively by all sorts of therapists. It was definitely an eye-opening grand rounds. Were you surprised when you started looking into it, the breadth of what was out there?
Yeah. Thank you for the compliment. So the way I went about was initially, I was asked to present the grand rounds. I was looking for topics really interest me. And all the way back when I was a second year resident, I remembered an incident when a veteran walked into PTSD clinic and started talking about how a particular app, PTSD Coach, that was developed by the VA system was helping him monitor and control symptoms. So this kind of was like a gateway. So I started looking into apps that were found to be useful in various disorders, like childhood disorders, to geriatric disorders, substance abuse disorders, to anxiety disorders. What I came across was an interesting data. Right now, we don't have much clear, robust evidence in favor of these apps.
Right. Now, you used a very interesting term during the grand rounds, digital psychiatry.
Right.
Can you tell us what that means?
Absolutely. So digital psychiatry is a broad term that encompasses the use of all digital tools in clinical practice that can vary from text messaging to emails to chatting to social networking and of course like blogs, websites and mental health apps. Of late, in the last 5 years, there's been tremendous growth and potential for mental health apps that has been appreciated by the psychiatrist community.
Now, when you say that there's been tremendous growth, are these applications that are coming from institutions like the VA, where there's a lot of research behind them, are they targeted, or are these apps that are some of these apps questionable in terms of their origins and how well researched they are?
Well, so you put it, you phrased it right. So we are not quite clear at this point what is the methodology by which they develop most of these apps. That is why the scientific evidence to use it as a clinical tool is really lacking. There have been various studies that looked into these apps. The findings are quite interesting. Right now, the number of mental health apps in Android or iTunes Store is about like 10,000.
Oh my gosh.
Which is like mind-boggling.
Had no idea it was that many.
And you tried them all.
Yes.
I wish I did. So when it comes to mindfulness-based apps alone, there are about like 700 of them.
Mm.
But if you look at the scientific evidence, you would find that not all of them have evidence. In fact, some of these apps give detrimental suggestions to people.
For
like people who have like a manic episode to go about having alcohol, which is quite really crazy.
Wow.
You found an application that did that.
Yeah. Some of these apps are do give suggestions that are actually quite harmful.
For context, we should talk a little bit about a manic episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a state where someone who has bipolar disorder mm-hmm. or otherwise induced by like a substance, they're not sleeping for days. They're not thinking correctly. They're very impulsive. They can get delusional, believe that God is talking to them. So I think you can imagine adding alcohol to that combination of symptoms could lead to a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So what you just said is really, you know,
right. mm-hmm.
it really captures how dangerous this is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising because you would think how harmful could an app be? It's not like you're giving someone a medication. It's not like you're giving someone something that's going to change their physiology. But in fact, this app actually is recommending that they mm-hmm. do that, that they add alcohol into right. an already, you know, manic patient. So yeah, it's pretty scary.
There are certain relaxation apps that recommend breathing patterns that are not so useful, but in fact, like harmful to patients with anxiety disorders.
Really? Mm. Like what?
Like rapid, shallow breathing.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Where, I wonder where they got this idea from.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Maybe they're like Russian hackers that are trying to tap into our mental health.
Is there any tips that you would have, not only for patients, but for providers in terms of looking through these apps and triaging which applications come from reputable organizations, like which ones maybe come from the VA, and which apps maybe to avoid? Are there any warning signs or red flags that you noticed?
Talking in broad terms, the apps that are developed by the VA system are generally more reliable. They have a very solid backing. Some of these apps, I would like to mention their names, PTSD Coach, T2 Mood Tracker, and there's another app developed by the VA called Virtual Hope Box, which has been compared with the traditional way of addressing people with PTSD, depressive symptoms, and suicidal ideations.
Mm-hmm.
People who used both the conventional and the mental health app, in this case Virtual Hope Box, did far better, and the veterans found it to be much more usable and convenient when it came to this app.
So give us a little idea. What does a Virtual Hope Box do?
So Virtual Hope Box is a tool that you have on your iPhone or Android. And whenever a veteran or any patient, for this matter, goes through an overwhelming PTSD episode, having experiences of flashbacks, having intense anxiety symptoms, going through dissociative symptoms, feeling hopeless.
And everyone can refer to mm-hmm. our prior episode on PTSD for more details about that.
And when they have these hopeless moments, they can turn to this app and look for coping skills like diaphragmatic breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, and to distract using like an activity planner or games that are inbuilt in the app. It also has an option to get in contact with supportive people. It could be a family member, it could be a friend or a mental health counselor or a therapist.
Are these apps, specifically the ones from the VA, are they gated in any way? Do you need to pay for them, or do they somehow check if you're a service member, or can anyone use this?
So these apps are like absolutely free, like anyone can download them from iTunes, App Store, or from Android. So it's quite open to the public. The thing about apps in general, I'm not referring to this particular app, most of these apps are free, but the cost of a free app is basically you. So there are some privacy concerns about apps that are developed by third parties. There is obviously some data being collected. People are quite skeptical about that particular issue as well. Mm-hmm.
Do you foresee yourself using these in your own practice to some extent?
So interestingly, in the last year or so, APA has come out with a model to evaluate an app. So you see a lot more patients in outpatient and inpatient settings, people asking a psychiatrist if they can try a particular app. What's a clinician's responsibility and role in this context? What APA basically recommends is to go over a few things. First of all, we'll have to look into the context and the background of these apps as to what they intend to do, whether they are harmful in the first place, if they give any kind of behavioral techniques that are not appropriate for that particular diagnosis. The next step is to look for potential benefit. Are some of these tools validated? Are some of these elements or some of these techniques conventionally used? The fourth thing to look for is usability and adherence. Just downloading an app doesn't mean the person is going to use on an everyday basis. Mm-hmm. How convenient and user-friendly it is. And finally, if there is any meaningful data that can be shared that can help in clinical diagnosis and treatment.
So do you, you know, subjectively for you specifically, do you think in your research, did you come across applications that you said, wow, I really could use this in my practice? Do you foresee yourself personally using these in the future? Or do you think that we're not quite there yet?
I would say that we are not quite there yet. There are a lot of patients who tell me they have used some apps that help them in coping with the anxious situations. Definitely, we need to build in more scientific means of like developing tools and safeguards addressing privacy concerns and issues.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you think that these apps are better when they're targeted at a specific, for example, do you think these apps are maybe more beneficial for people who suffer from disorders where there's a significant component of anxiety? Or do you think that these apps are better maybe for people who suffer with psychotic disorders? Or do you think they can be used generally speaking? Have you noticed a trend in terms of...
In general, one tends to imagine that these apps are used by people who are quite high functioning, who are looking for positive well-being. And obviously, people with anxiety disorders and depressive disorders tend to download them and use it more. However, there are some apps that are developed to ensure compliance as well. Interestingly, in the recent years, one pharmaceutical company came up with a pill that can ensure compliance that basically monitors if a patient is taking a pill or not. I would say it's a little bit stretching the paternalistic component a little too far. But certainly we are not there yet when it comes to applying these apps for psychotic disorders.
What do you think about the app as a transitional object?
Actually, that's not a bad idea, to be honest with you.
An extension of the therapy that a patient takes with them into their daily life?
That's a very good question. So thing is, when it comes to using these apps, basically let us look at how much a cell phone can be used as an extension of a clinician. What a cell phone can do is to translate real-world data and help a clinician understand what's going on in a patient's life, like tracking movement, number of hours he's sleeping, number of times he's actually going out and socializing, and how much is his heart rate variability. These are some of the examples that, you know, I can imagine now. When a clinician interacts with the patient in his office, overall, he might be conveying his experiences, but there's a lot of retrospective bias as well. So psychiatry has had this deficiency of not accurately capturing symptoms in real life, unlike telemetry or like video EEG. So this particular deficiency could be addressed better, I think, in the years to come.
Right. So like a Holter monitor for your psychiatric
symptoms. Exactly. Yeah. And I think it also brings up a similar point, which is that when we assess patients, it's not just what they tell us. I think clinicians from other fields don't really realize the extent to which we're observing them, we're examining them. I have a lot of patients kind of frustrated that there are no, we don't do any, well, we do blood work actually. But generally speaking, we don't confirm diagnosis with blood work or imaging. And I'd like to tell them that we are the MRI. When we're talking to you, we're not just listening to what you're saying. We're kind of looking at your brain, you know, as if we had an x-ray and we're, you know, examining your thought process, you know, your thought content. That's very interesting because we see the patient, let's say we see a patient once a month or in some cases once every 3 months. We don't know what they're like the other 20 whatever days out of the month, you know, so an app could help us kind of capture that information.
I think it's also interesting. So, you know, my question was, you know, how can this benefit the patient essentially, like in terms of being a transitional object for the patient? Is this something that they will find comfort in? And I think it's interesting that you came back and said, well, actually, it's telling maybe this is more information for us. Maybe actually for us as clinicians, apps can be even more useful than to patients because it's, in a way, it's almost like getting collateral.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Right. When we speak with a patient, we always want to know what the people around them, you know, experience, what their family members that are with them all the time have to say. Because in some instances, they're purposefully misleading us with their symptoms or, you know, how things are going. But more generally speaking, you know, it's hard to have an outside perspective of yourself. You know, you may think everything is okay or everything is not okay, but somebody who's observing you as an outside observer might have a completely different opinion.
Everyone has an innate, I think most people have an innate desire to present themselves as doing better than they are. I've noticed it myself when I go to my therapist mm-hmm. and how are you doing?
Right.
Oh, great, that's great, true. Great. And then over the course of the session, maybe a couple of things will mm-hmm. come out that I didn't even realize were bothering me. So it's just another way of getting some additional information.
Absolutely. And if you look at smartphones, many more people are beginning to use smartphones. By the year 2020, you will see there are 6.1 billion people who will be using mobile phones.
Wow.
And of these, like 3 billion people are smartphone users. Mm-hmm. So wow. There's an enormous therapeutic benefit by using a smartphone mm-hmm. As a device to capture symptoms.
Now, but I have one concern about getting all of this information. Mm-hmm. Our assessments, they're predicated on a system where we see the patient mm-hmm. occasionally. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is different, you know, than inpatient where you see the patient every day. But as on an outpatient basis, mm-hmm. you know, we see the patients like once every so-and-so interval. Do you think there's such thing as too much information?
The data that we get from these apps is definitely a supplement, and right. it's not going to replace our clinical judgment.
Mm-hmm. I'll mention my concern. So there's something we call iatrogenic injury.
Mm-hmm.
When a patient is in the hospital and their blood pressure goes up, automatically we give them a medication. Mm-hmm. You know, when the heart rate goes up, we give them a medication. When they have a fever, we give them a medication. These patients oftentimes have these symptoms at home and don't take anything, and these things resolve on their mm-hmm. own.
Right.
And mm-hmm. there's a potential every time that we make a move, you know, for harm to come. So there's a chance that if we have too much information, you know, we may be tempted to make changes more frequently than really we should, because the mm-hmm. studies that we're basing our recommendations mm-hmm. on are based on changing the medication every few weeks or every few months.
So to address this concern, I think as a clinician, when we work with our patients, it's the clinician's discretion to see if this particular patient is going to benefit by using this app.
Right.
And if there is going to be a component just by using this app, this patient is going to be more conscious and be more dysfunctional. If it's going to impair and interfere with his life, I think at that point in time, we shouldn't be recommending using any app.
Right. So I think what you're saying more broadly is that we're going to have to adapt the way that we practice to this new technology.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be more individual based. We will have to tailor the needs from time to time. And as we are dealing with the same patient as well over a period of time, we might have to assess if it's going to be beneficial or not. So definitely, there are a lot of commercialized products out there offering many unproven treatments and that can have potential detrimental effects. And as a psychiatrist of today, one needs to be educated and up to date about what patients are using.
Right, that's true.
And just like how we ask about nutritional supplements,
right.
That, you know, that could be having a dangerous interaction with medications that we prescribe, one needs to ask for...
An excellent point, because I think at least I have been approaching it from the delusion that we have some sort of control, whether the patient uses the app or not. But the truth is, you know, people are going to use them regardless of what we say. So we have to be ready to incorporate that information into our practice.
What do you think of people using phones for telepsychiatry?
Again, some of the important concerns that arise with using a phone is whether the interaction and the data is secure, whether it's a secure connection. Mm-hmm. A lot of hospitals are turning to telepsychiatry because there is no in-house psychiatrist, mm-hmm. especially after 5 p.m., after 7 p.m., like patients have to wait in the emergency room. One has to make sure whatever product they are using, it's secure and the data is protected.
But also, don't you think that something is lost regarding that question, that something is lost when you don't have the face-to-face encounter? This is more of a question about telepsychiatry in general.
Absolutely. We are all humans and nothing can replace in-person care. But we are living in an age where there's need for more psychiatrists. And there are hospitals in the interior of the country. There are places where to see a psychiatrist, it takes about like 2 to 3 hours. So one needs to be mindful of these logistics as well and put technology to best use.
That's true, yeah. I mean, even here in this area, you can wait 3 months easily to get your first appointment with an outpatient psychiatrist.
Sure.
And this is, you know, for people who don't know, right outside of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I can imagine in, you know, a more rural area where there's one psychiatrist for like an entire county.
I recently started doing telepsychiatry at the VA. And I will say that when I first started doing it, I was very wary and I was worried about feeling distanced from the patient and not feeling like I'm making a meaningful connection. And maybe it's because at the VA, the patients present to these community-based outpatient clinics and then they call in. And on both ends, you're using this very specialized, very good technology. Mm-hmm. The picture is very clear. The sound is very loud. Even if the patient is talking quietly, you can hear them very well. And I was surprised. I really didn't feel like there was that big of a barrier. And I've only done initial assessments with this technology. Mm-hmm. So it's the, you know, your first impression, your first time meeting a patient.
Yeah.
And I was actually surprised at the extent to which I was able to make a connection. You know, I definitely could see myself using that technology in the future, but it really was predicated on the strength of the connection and feeling like because of the fidelity, like the patient was really there.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. This technology can be put to great use, given the constraints that we have. In addition, I would add that, you know, if the first assessment, the first encounter with the patient, if it was in person and we have already built up a rapport, this telepsychiatry model can be of much greater use.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To provide a counterpoint, we all work in a place where we use telepsychiatry overnight when there's not a psychiatrist, an attending psychiatrist available. And sometimes the connection, because of the way the building is laid out, can be poor. And I think the encounter there can suffer. So a lot of times the attending psychiatrist will just, even though they can technically see the patient, will say that, you know, this patient needs to be assessed in person by a psychiatrist.
And I certainly think in the hospital, it's especially when you're talking with family members, there's not just one person in the room. I think that in person is probably best. I think for mostly stable outpatient individuals, I think it might be beneficial. But I am very frustrated personally when, for example, we're doing telepsychiatry and maybe you're talking to not just the patient, but the family. And just functionally, logistically, it gets very complicated and frustrating, not just for me, but for the patient and their family. But I do think, you know, for more stable patients, for outpatient, I think there might be a future there.
Well, I hope so, because we're doing it.
Yeah, it is the future.
Exactly.
There's no doubt about it.
The future is here.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that in the future, Senthil, they're going to integrate some of the features of these apps with telepsychiatry? So, for example, on-demand telepsychiatry, you clock into the app, you're doing some symptom monitoring, you trip a sensor because maybe you were previously, you know, 15 out of 30 on the depression scale. Now you're 20. Maybe the app suggests, hey, you should probably speak to someone. Do you foresee a future in that's happening? And if that happens, would you be comfortable with that?
So these are like innovative ideas. Capturing symptoms and changes over a period of time is something a mental health app, you know, it can be a very promising tool. And for the right patient, a right app is absolutely a boon for a psychiatrist. It saves time. It helps in, you know, better precision in identifying symptoms. And not only that, in developing a therapeutic plan. Integrating telepsychiatry with mental health apps, a brilliant idea. I think we are getting closer and closer to that.
All right, guys, I think it's about that time to talk about the top five things that you need to know about mental health apps. Number one.
There are numerous apps on Android and iTunes Store. There are about 10,000 of them. But most of these products are commercialized and offer unproven treatments.
Number two. The flip side is that there are some evidence-based apps out there. There's particularly some from the VA, and we'll link those below.
Number three, you have a duty as the provider, if the patient is telling you that they're using a certain app, to investigate the app, and using those five criteria that Senthil mentioned, see if this app is doing more harm than good.
Number four, there's another type of harm that needs to be considered, which are privacy issues. Patients are putting their information into these apps, and the question is, where is that information going?
And finally, I would like to conclude with a quote from Bill Gates. We always overestimate the change that will occur in the next 2 years and underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. Don't let yourself be lulled into inaction.
That's amazing.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Senthil, are you taking donations for your cult yet?
Anyone is welcome.
Dr. Rajaram has been my spiritual guru. yes. for the last couple of years, and he'll be leaving us soon. I'm very sad, but we want to wish you the absolute best going forward. We know you're going to be an excellent psychiatrist, a leader in the field.
Yes. And I think one of your greatest attributes is that your force of personality and your happiness was present from the first moment I met you as a medical student. And you were on your neurology rotation and you kind of were bubbly and happy and you came up and you made a joke to me. And that has remained true throughout the duration of the residency to this day. So I think if you continue bringing that to your patient interactions, I think the world will be better for it.
Thank you, Raf and James. I'm absolutely delighted and humbled by your words. We'll stay in touch. And
lies.
Yeah. Over the years, we'll
meet again.
Yeah, we'll meet again. In the numerous conferences that'll be coming up over the years.
We'll meet again when I'm 80, but he's somehow still in his mid-30s, and he's taking care of me in the nursing home.
We have the APA coming up in Philadelphia next year, so hopefully we'll be meeting then.
You'll be in Philly, of course.
Okay.
You're not going anywhere.
Yeah, so you can, you know, walk out his door.
All right.
We'd like to sign off, as always, by reminding our listeners that if you need help, it is out there, and we definitely encourage you to seek it out. You do not have to suffer alone. There are a huge number of mental health professionals in this country who would be happy to help, whether it's depression, anxiety, negative thoughts, negative self-image, addiction, you know, whatever you might be going through, there's someone out there who can and wants to help. You can find them in a variety of ways. You can find them using your own health insurance if you happen to have it. You can find them using resources at university hospitals that usually have free or low-cost mental health services. You can also use Psychology Today or other publications like that. And we really would just encourage you, if you're suffering, to reach out and get some help.
And remember, mental health issues, they're not a sign of weakness. They're not moral failings. They're medical conditions that can be treated. All right. I think that's it, James. So until next time.
Adios.
Peace.